Hi, and welcome back to the 4th Annual Online Conference for Mothers Fighting Autism. We are very lucky to have with us now Lisa Lieberman. She is a clinical social worker. She does private counseling, has a private counseling practice, and she's a specialist in living with people with disabilities. She is the author of A Stranger Among Us, Hiring In-Home Support When a Child Has ASD or Other Neurological Differences. Lisa is also the mother of a 24-year-old son with autism spectrum disorder. Welcome to the show, Lisa. Thank you for being here with us.
It's great to be here, and it's really an honor to be among this impressive lineup of presenters. I was so happy to hear Dr. Tippy and Dr. Shore today as well, because both of them really spoke to the importance of treating everybody with respect and not necessarily seeing people with ASD as being all that different from anybody else. That was really important. I don't think you can ever hear that enough. I'm going to share some ideas that I've thought about in regard to parenting young adults with autism, based partly on my own parenting experiences, as well as the wisdom that's been imparted from other adults that I know with ASD, who I've had the pleasure of knowing. I've spoken all over the country, and I have met so many wonderful adults who are on spectrum. And although the input from adults on spectrum is really valuable, mostly I will be speaking today from the perspective of being a parent. And I think what I have to say is going to be relevant to parents of younger children, as well as parents of children whose kids are in the transitional or young adult age. Because there is an overlap of skills. Plus, for that to be the most successful, we need to start young. So let me just give you a framework in which I think about kids and families on the autism spectrum. When a child's diagnosed with an autism spectrum difference, parents set out on a journey through uncharted territory. There are hazards when you go on a sailing journey. There's storms. There's challenges. There's surprises. And unexpected gifts. And when we parent teens and young adults with autism, it gradually requires a new perspective that complements all the skills we learned when parenting younger children. And it also demands an array of supports from a wide variety of people in the community. When I first prepared this talk, I was really surprised at how little had been written on this subject. But as our children grow up and face new challenges, we parents are also charting new waters. And let me tell you a little bit about what I plan to cover today. Before talking specifically about parenting adolescents and adults with autism, let's imagine any family starting out in life together. So think of your family life as a sailing voyage. You set out with an idea of where you're headed, but the weather and the tide and the winds of life influence your direction, influences the quality of the ride, and ultimately influences the destination. And you'll hear me say this a few times to the point where you might say, okay, Lisa, that's enough, but I think it's an important point, and I'm hoping there are professionals listening. It's an essential focus for anybody who steps on that boat, even for a short time, to always be thinking about how do I empower this family, and even more importantly, how do I empower this person with ASD to sail on as independently as possible. So the more skilled that a family is in quote-unquote sailing, the more solid the boat. And the more boats from the community that move in tandem with each other, the greater chance of reaching an intended destination with relatively smooth sailing. Of course, there are never any guarantees for any parents how that journey will turn out, whether or not you have a child diagnosed with autism. But sailing in community provides greater assurance of a safe voyage. We need each other. I wrote an article that's on my website. It was on the original slide. It's disability in the family, disabilityinthefamily.com, disabilityinthefamily.com. And there's a one link that's articles to download. And the most recent article that's on that website is called The Gift of Interdependence, Nobody Survives Alone. And I'll be talking about some of those issues. So let's talk about some of the things we need on a sailing voyage. And last year, if any of you were part of this conference, I gave a talk on what I call the 6 tools for navigating the emotional journey. And I'm just going to do a really quick review. Starting from the left, you can see the compass. And the compass relates to the tool of allowing all feelings and knowing what our feelings are as parents as we go through this. And the reason it's the compass is that we have so many decisions to make along the way that we need to be able to tune in to where we're at and where we want to go, which leads to the second tool, which is opening to new dreams. And when you set out on this voyage, you have an idea of where you want to go. You have a vision. You have goals. And the third tool, you can see the little book with the eye on it, is usually where parents start when they get a diagnosis, and that's information, gathering information and training. And we're all pretty good about that, but I think it's also important in the process to take the time to figure out where are we at emotionally and where are we trying to get. What are we hoping for our child and our family? The fourth tool, the little four people with the globe, are some of the ambassador skills. And that goes two ways. We are constantly having to interpret to be an ambassador to the world about our child's autism. But by the same token, I think the job of us as parents is interpreting the world for our children with autism, explaining the rules that don't make sense by osmosis. The fifth tool is the crew. We can't do it alone. And again, I could talk for the whole hour and a half just on that one subject. And the sixth tool, the little scale, is the idea that we need balance. When you're on that journey, you need, maybe to make it more of a nautical theme, ballast for that boat. But the balance is between being a parent of a child with autism and being a person and finding ways to meet your needs that are outside the role of being a parent. So that's a very quick overview. I want to ask you all to take a moment and think about your teens. And for those of you who have non-spectrum teens, what are your main concerns? What do you lie awake at night worrying about? Now, those of you who have teens on the spectrum or young children on spectrum, ask yourself the same question. What are your main concerns? And what do you worry about at night for your kids? If we were all in a room together, I'd be willing to wager that some of your concerns for your teens with ASD would differ considerably from what you worry about for your non-spectrum teens. Obviously, there's similarities as well. But let's face it, it's the differences that drive the need to focus on today's topic, because there are some different skills that are required for those of us who are parenting teens on the spectrum. All parents worry about their kids as they transition into adulthood. I have two older children that I raised from my husband's first marriage who are now 40 and 42. They lived with us. I remember lying awake in the wee hours when either of these older two kids were out on a date or gallivanting around with friends. Because typically developing adolescents tend to push away and define themselves in less than desirable ways. So parental anxiety for our non-spectrum teens often stems from reacting to this pushing away behavior. We might be concerned about them finding a niche in young adulthood, but usually there's an underlying assumption that they'll get a job, become self-supporting, eventually find a life partner, and likely have a family of their own if that's what they want. So in short, the assumption for typically developing teens is that life will continue to get better as they leave high school, and move on into their adult life. I don't remember worrying so much about my older kids' future. I just felt somehow they'd find their way and they'd be able to take care of themselves. For most families with typically developing children, there are predictable times when that teen steps off the boat. He leaves for college, she takes off to explore the world, or marry, or start her own family. Her own sailing voyage, that is. Sometimes he embarks on a parallel life journey. Sometimes she explores new waters far away. But ultimately, and this is my little joke, instead of the empty nest, I'm calling it the empty boat syndrome, the parents, whether together, divorced, or widowed, sail on alone. Granted, it takes longer these days due to changes in our economy for any child to leave the nest or the boat, but eventually our non-spectrum kids are able to be launched on their own life voyage. You know, adult children might come back from time to time and bring along grandchildren to step on and off the boat for a short time. And I describe this rosy little scenario a little with tongue-in-cheek, because the bottom line is every family, including ours, has its challenges, and the range of normal gets broader over time. But I do think it's safe to say that the majority of children with autism will likely need people to stay on that boat with them for a longer time. Parents, other family members, neighbors, friends are part of that crew. But professionals mostly climb aboard for a short time, and whenever they're on that boat, and forgive my repetition, they must remember their ultimate goal in any intervention is to empower the family and child to sail on as independently as possible. I'd like to share an additional perspective on this continuum of dependence and independence that gets talked about so much in our culture. Barbara Gill, in her book Changed by a Child, points out that dependence has become almost a dirty word in our culture, and independence for persons with disabilities has become a much-cited goal. Yet, health and appropriate dependence and interdependence are essential to human life and community. And in the name of independence, many people have been left bereft and alone. Although we want our adult children to function as independently as possible, we mustn't forget that all of us need other people, and the notion of interdependence is a more accurate description of humans living in community. And again, I talk about this at greater length in the article that I mentioned on my website called The Gift of Interdependence. So let's explore a little bit about the similarities between adolescents with autism and those who are not on the spectrum. Lori is a psychiatric nurse practitioner here in the Portland, Oregon area who specializes in autism. So I asked her about this topic, and she emphatically stated adolescence for ASD is not so different for teens with autism, just bigger. The intensity of behavior and emotions experienced is so often much greater than that of non-spectrum teens. I think that I actually put in the wrong word there. Adolescence for ASD is not so different for teens without autism, just bigger. My friend Gail Gillingham is an author and autism consultant in Canada. She described to me how the adolescent brain produces new gray matter. So it's a time of turmoil for any teen as those new synapses form. And for those with autism, the internal experience can be even more extreme. The anxiety builds faster and is more powerful. But the internal thoughts and feelings are not so different from any other teen. Ian Weatherby is a 30-something-year-old non-speaking man with autism from Indiana. So Ian found his voice through typing at the age of 13. And he stresses that teens with autism have the same emotions as any other teen. He describes his experience he had in a high school chemistry lab. The other students in the lab might not see past my outer experience and movement differences, and therefore miss who I am. Girls will miss my very handsome face. The guys across the room seem to be laughing at me. My dad explained that every high school student had those same thoughts. When I have them now, I remember that inside my autistic body, I am just like everybody else. We all have the same insecurities and fears. No one escapes pity parties. But the unique issues also exist for parents of teens and adults on the autism spectrum. For one thing, we parents whose children have autism don't automatically assume things will get better after high school. Fewer people automatically step on and off that boat after a child is out of school. There's a loss of support after high school, wait lists, less opportunities for social interaction, HIPAA confidentiality laws that require a decision whether to seek guardianship in order to remain involved, although there are ways to manage to work around that. We face the task of intentionally creating opportunities for individualized support in the form of visual systems and community supports and mentorship, because we can't expect to be our child's primary support in the adult world. In addition, it's difficult to let go of thinking about how poorly our children have been treated in this culture because of their differences. Many kids with autism grow up in a hostile environment, sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle. And I'm not talking about within their home necessarily, I'm talking about outside the home. As a result, we parents are understandably anxious and hypervigilant about how people treat our kids. We move in closer to protect, to advocate, and to fight ignorance. We incessantly worry about how their lives will turn out. Will he find meaningful work? Will she have satisfying intimate relationships? Will he be around people who are respectful of his sensory and movement challenges? Where will she live? Will he have a home of his own? Will she be able to grow old in a community of her choice and feel like she belongs? I was really glad that Minta forwarded me some questions ahead of time that had already come in, and I wanted to respond to one of them now. It was such a great question. Carol from LA, who has asked many great questions, I've heard her questions on some of the other talks today. She asked about how do we prepare our people on spectrum for intimate relationships, and can we expect there, if they marry a non-spectrum person, is that person going to be willing to be understanding? And actually, I think this question is so good it warrants a whole additional workshop, but of course, I'm just going to hit a few points. First of all, I think it's really important to get our teens and young adults to articulate what their own goals are. In other words, do they have motivation for having a relationship in the future? How important is it to them? Because it's really hard to work with someone who doesn't share that as a goal, even though we as parents may dream about that for our kids on spectrum. So we may want so much for our kids to have an intimate partner and be part of another sailing voyage with another adult. But we have to stop and talk with our kids and find out, is that really something that feels important to them? Because if you don't have that buy-in and that mutual goal, then there really isn't much that you can do to get them to buy into making some of the changes that are going to help them be more successful in intimate relationships. With my own son, I watch for opportunities to demonstrate perspective taking, because I think perspective taking is an important part of being in an intimate relationship. Somebody said earlier, I think Dr. Tippy was saying, having the ability to recognize that somebody else has a different mind than we do. I'll give you a really simple example. I just actually had a conversation with my son about this. I've noticed a couple times when I go in the bathroom that there's an empty toilet paper roll, and I'm pretty sure he's the one who was there before me. So I just went in and talked to him a few minutes ago, and I asked him, hey, do you know how to change toilet paper rolls? Because so many times we assume that just because something is really simple, that our whatever age person on the spectrum knows how to do something. And I said, have you ever changed toilet paper rolls? And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, I'm just curious on those times when you haven't changed the toilet paper roll, what did you tell yourself that made you walk away and not do it? So I'm sort of approaching him more with curiosity rather than, geez, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you doing this? And he said, well, you know, sometimes I might be thinking about something else, or sometimes I might say, well, I'll get back to this later. And he said, but, you know, I'm realizing I probably ought to just do it right then. And he said, you know, Mom, when I'm other places, like in a public restroom, he said, I will make a point of telling them when they're out of toilet paper. And I said, oh, that's great, because what you're doing is you're taking the perspective of the next person who's coming in. And then I said, you know, it would be really great if you would take that same perspective for people in your own home. So, you know, my son does tend to get defensive if he feels like he's made a mistake, but I was able to have that conversation with him in a way where he didn't feel attacked or criticized. I was really kind of more interviewing him to understand what his thinking was about that. And he says, yeah, I think you're right. Now, trust me, this kind of conversation did not come overnight. We've had 24 years of getting to know each other and making mistakes and stepping on bombs and all of that. But that was a successful interaction. Let me give you a few more examples that I can can give that talk about how to help give a person on spectrum perspective. So he might have something on his mind, and we haven't seen each other. He does live with us still at this point. And he might want to come up to me the minute he walks in and start talking about something, or the minute I walk in from work. So I might say to him, you know, when you get home from work and you come in from the bus, what's the first thing you want to do? And he would say, well, you know, I kind of want to go in my room and chill out, kind of get some balance back. He's a very healthy individual emotionally. He knows when he needs to take a break. And I said, what would it be like for you when you walk in the door if I immediately want you to talk about something really important? And actually, I do that sometimes. And then I realize that I'm not being very respectful of his needs. And so that's another way to just sort of give him the perspective of what it would be like, but to do it in a way that's respectful and non-attacking. He has a real thing about not liking anybody to touch his hair. He's really, really over-focused on his hair being perfect. So sometimes I'll tease him and I'll go to, like, reach out to touch his hair, and then he'll jerk away and, Mom, quit that. And I'll say, oh, honey, you want to be in a relationship with a woman, you're going to have to understand she's going to see your gorgeous face and she's going to want to touch your hair, you know. And then he'll think about that for a while. A couple times he said to me, okay, go ahead and touch it. But he's really saying to me, okay, I got to get ready for this because this is really jarring to me. I'm just giving you some examples of ways that I'm constantly looking for ways to give him perspective on other people in his life. And I think that the conversations start pretty early. Another thing we might do in preparing for an intimate relationship is to even give a formula for when you have a conversation. These are for people on spectrum who are speaking. So when he meets someone new, I might say to him, okay, here's something I want you to try. For every statement you make about yourself, and that's two sentences, that's not four paragraphs, I want you to turn around and ask them a question about them. And I want you to listen to their answer. And that's really tough. But I just keep reinforcing that. We've also taught our son how to give compliments because that's part of flirting. And, you know, that had to be fine-tuned because early on he would give compliments that, first of all, he might say, oh, I really like your hair. It looks really pretty around your face. Well, that's getting a little personal for somebody you don't know very well. Or he might give somebody three compliments at once, which sort of feels like stalking. So then we would have conversations afterwards about that. So now he's learned to say, I really like your nail polish, or I really like those earrings, or those earrings look really good with your outfit. And obviously he's saying that to women, and the women are thrilled to have somebody notice something that they're not used to having men necessarily notice. Another thing I think you can do is to have many discussions about what makes a relationship successful, and model those skills in your own relationships. That's a biggie. On the end of my slides, I have a reference to a book by Teresa Bolick called Asperger's and Adolescence, and she covers the elements of friendships and intimate relationships in great detail and what are some areas that you really need to touch on. And, of course, there are countless books about Asperger marriage. I just heard about one last night called Asperger Love that's only available digitally. It's two people who are in a relationship, both are on spectrum, and they're both in college. And the picture evidently on the front of the book is of two goldfish, each in their own bowl, looking at each other. And I think they talk a lot about how they found a way to make it work for them. So thank you so much, Carol, for that question. It was a really important one. I'm going to move on. And this business about being enmeshed, I've been a psychotherapist for over 35 years now, and sometimes I get a little embarrassed by people in my profession, especially when we use words like enmeshed. Parents of older teens are sometimes accused of being too controlling and are unfairly labeled as being enmeshed with that child. So one way to define enmeshment is a parent who has difficulty perceiving their child's capabilities as separate from their own. So the assumption would follow that that parent would find it hard to allow a child to progress and be fearful that their child would grow and develop into a separate and independent person. Well, I don't know about you, but I find this accusation of enmeshment a bit ludicrous, because it's the anxiety about the future security of our teen that naturally drives us to encourage more independence while cultivating additional supports in the community. So what somebody might erroneously call enmeshed behavior should be reframed as a need to protect and provide structure that can support our older children to be safer as they sail on their journey. We parents often perform a role of executive function. And most of you probably know what executive function is, but I'll just say really briefly, it's the frontal lobe of the brain that allows us to multitask. It allows us to put things in the proper sequence. It has to do with short and long-term memory. And many of our kids on spectrum have poor executive function. So we parents end up doing a lot of that executive function. Do you have your homework? Did you have your key? Did you bring your phone? Do you have your wallet? Do you have your lunch? All of those things have to do with executive function. And yes, visual systems will help reduce the amount of that parents have to help our kids do that. But if we're going to be responsible about it, we turn the helm over the helm slowly with foresight and planning for ways that we can individualize the support for that young adult. As I said already, most of our kids will need some degree of help, but the amount of which depends on their specific strengths and as he or she slowly transitions into adult life. The stakes are so high for us as parents to feel comfort with our teen or adult's developmental readiness to sail on. And being able to let go involves having an idea where that teen or adult is in their emotional development. And that's where we can find that balance between being protective and letting go. Mary is a psychotherapist in private practice, and she had a daughter in her late 30s with a developmental disability. And she said those stakes are higher if your child lacks good judgment. She might unknowingly get herself in a risky situation and not be able to pull herself out of it. It frightens her that her daughter doesn't see the real catastrophic consequences that can result from poor judgment. She understands that those community and visual supports must be in place in order to protect her. Some more issues with autism. The stages of development are tricky to assess in ASD. For example, somebody might assume that a person with ASD is functioning at a specific level of understanding in regard to communication. But when a teen or adult has a good vocabulary and they have strong expressive language, we can easily overlook the difficulty that person might have comprehending the meaning of words that they hear auditorily. By the same token, they may be expected to function beyond their capability because a parent's ready to be released from performing that executive function role. It's easy to understand how a mom who's raised four kids is itching to have that youngest out of the family boat. But one mom whose son is 19, at a national conference I was speaking at, she told me that her biggest challenge was to let go of imposing shoulds on her son. Why hasn't he taken on this responsibility yet? He's 19, for goodness sake. She told me that she gets calmer by remembering that he's on his own timeline. She knows he'll do what he can when he can do it. And this boils down to recognizing a potential discrepancy between chronological and developmental age. Tony Atwood always talked about how there was he was one of the earlier people to write about Asperger's. He talked about how a lot of people on spectrum are two-thirds their chronological age emotionally. And I'm not saying that's true for everybody, but it's a good rule of thumb to at least examine that idea that if you have a 16-year-old, what's two-thirds of 16? About 11 or 12, that they might actually be emotionally at a 11 or 12-year-old level instead of a 16-year-old level. And then so you don't expect 16-year-old behavior from them in that regard. Overall, what we hear repeatedly, or what I hear repeatedly from people on the spectrum, because I do have many people I know all over the country, is that when people in their lives, including their parents, hold higher expectations, it affords more opportunities for growth as they rise to the level of a greater challenge. By the same token, limited expectations will limit options for growth. We can err on the side of underestimating if we're not looking through the right lens. And I mentioned Ian earlier. At a conference in 1999, he typed, "I'm autistic, and until I was 13 years old, people thought I was very mentally disabled. I'm unable to talk, and I couldn't tell anyone that I wasn't mentally handicapped. They couldn't know that I like my life and had chosen to live each day as a gift from God. They also couldn't know that I was able to follow and enjoy intellectually challenging conversations, television shows, movies, and dissertations." I want to mention really quickly, these quotes came from a book, I'm blocking the name of the book. It's on the last slide. Sharing Our Wisdom, it's called. And this is a book of adults with autism, some non-speaking, some not, who are talking about their own experience. It's available, I think it's available on Amazon. I have it available, I have copies of it available if people are interested. I have another person also quoted from this book. Sandra Radish is, in her words, 50-something. She lives in California. She says, "I'm bright, I'm talented, I have hopes and dreams, and I have problems. My voice does not work properly. It's not under my control, and I cannot say what I want to when I want to. All the tests I was given were used to describe what I couldn't do. Limits were set by others, and I learned to believe them, even though I knew I was capable in my mind. I happen to have a body that does not perform in accordance with my mind's commands, so I cannot demonstrate competence, and I will add, in the way that people can recognize competence. Sometimes I get stuck, and I can't get started again." Another way that underestimating takes place is when a parent overlooks new development in their child and operates with old information about what skills that child has mastered. "I still start to do things for my son, and he has to remind me that he's quite capable of doing it himself. And he's also quick to tell me if he needs my help, he'll ask for it." So with all of this talk of overestimating and underestimating, I run the risk of eclipsing a more significant issue. We must all do whatever we can to teach, promote, and support the development of advocacy skills for our teens and adults with ASD, and ideally this starts at a much earlier age. Minta mentioned that I had written a book, it's called A Stranger Among Us, which is a very comprehensive guide to hiring in-home support for children and young adults on the spectrum. But what I'm most proud of in that book is I devote a full chapter to how a person can begin to promote self-advocacy skills in our children, even from a very young age. And I'm just going to read the six suggestions that I have for promoting self-advocacy. I don't have time to go into them. Verbalize observations about how your child is responding. In other words, oh, I see that you weren't very comfortable when Susie walked in the door. It looks like there's something about her that makes you uncomfortable. That might be something. Or provide your child with opportunities to make choices, which could start, you know, do you want to wear the red shirt or the green shirt, which is just plain good parenting, and then broaden that to giving three choices or having the child make a choice about what activity they want to do. Number three, let your child experience the power of saying no. We want them to learn to say no at a young age so that when they are met with experiences in their middle teen years, for example, early teen years, that they won't be led down the wrong path because they haven't learned to say no with comfort. Help your child recognize his own internal sensations and emotions. And again, I could talk for hours just on that. Give your child words to describe how he or she is feeling. And because in the context of this book, the sixth point was to solicit feedback regularly from your child about current providers, you know, people who are helping them in school or helping them in their home or whatever, so that you're saying to them, hey, I want to know how it's going for you, and I'm interested, and if something is making you uncomfortable, I want you to let me know. And this is whether or not they are speaking or non-speaking. If our children are to develop any semblance of living a self-determined life, they must be supported to speak on their own half whenever possible. It means nothing to promote the idea of being able to sail on as independently as possible if our kids lack ample opportunity for practicing and mastering self-advocacy skills. Part of promoting advocacy includes supporting our kids to become familiar with the workings of their own body and how it reacts to the environment. Gail Gillingham elaborated on this in an email to me, and she's written a couple of wonderful books. For each, this is a unique journey, as each body is unique. They, the teens, need to know about their own sensory reactions, their individual motor planning problems, how anxiety builds in the environments they are placed in, how they best cope with this anxiety, because anxiety is common in so many of our kids. This knowledge will enable them to participate in addressing their own individual needs. And this leads to another question that was sent in yesterday that I wanted to address directly. Somebody asked, when do you tell a child or do you tell a child about their diagnosis? And I have a strong bias that children deserve to know what they're dealing with. I don't think it's a matter of waiting till they ask. I think it's important to talk about it in a positive way. There's wonderful books out there. But every adult that I've ever asked who's on the spectrum, with the exception of one person who had some other mental health issues, and autism is not a mental health issue, but this woman had mental health issues, have said to me, absolutely, it's important for children to know what they're dealing with. It's important for them to know their brain's wired a little differently, that they have gifts to offer the world. You can talk about a lot of the famous people who have either posthumously been diagnosed with autism or who are out there in the culture now, and the kind of contributions that they brought. It should be framed as a positive and not as something that's anything to be ashamed of or anything that creates a lot of pessimism. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit, because another issue that surfaces from time to time is parental sadness over what we perceive our children to be missing. Periodically, I find myself feeling grief, similarly to how I felt with the initial unveiling of my son's diagnosis. I would see my son Jordan's peers reach milestones currently out of his reach, driving, college graduation, traveling around with friends, dating, marrying, developing a career, and probably the most painful, having a real friendship. And as it is for many of you, the sadness comes in waves. I hurt for him when what he wants most is just to hang out with other people his own age, to truly feel that he belongs in the world. And it hurts to hear him wistfully say, maybe I'll finally have a girlfriend later in my 20s, or to hear him rationalize that finding friends where he lives is harder because it's such a small community. By now, the importance of listening and learning from those who have firsthand experience living with autism is pretty obvious. Suffice to say, staying current and is about tuning into the plethora of new information and research that is out there about ASD. But it's also important to continue challenging what is out there with what we know to be true about our kids, because not every strategy is good for every kid. And parents are usually better experts about autism, not to mention those people who live with it firsthand every day. Sometimes it's difficult to not confuse what is a can't on the part of your child from what is a won't with their behavior. And the best course of action I learned early on is to start with the assumption that if your teen or young adult is struggling with something, it's not volitional or it's not intentional. They're not doing it on purpose. My son has to occasionally remind me that when he's forgotten something and I'm getting a little frustrated with him, it doesn't mean he's not trying. And just to take this outside the realm of autism for a moment, truth be told, most conflicts of any of our human relationships stem from misinterpreting behavior as a won't instead of a can't. Let me give you an example. First of all, I want to say that having the assumption of won't, that somebody won't do something you want them to do, feeds our rage, which just escalates the situation. My husband's listening to this, so I have to be careful what I say here, but I'll give you a really good example. He is somebody who needs to think about things. I am really quick on my feet. I'm very articulate with what I feel, and maybe that also follows, you know, a lot of gender differences. So if I ask him to give me an emotional response to something that's just occurred, and he doesn't, and I fall into that, why won't he open up and tell me this? I'm going to start to get irritated. But if I really come to accept that, okay, he is different than me, there's another mind, we need theory of mind as adults as well, not just our kids need it, that maybe this is not his strength, and that he has told me many times over the 34 years we've been married that he needs to process things. So I've learned along the way, this is a can't, not a won't, if I'm insisting on this happening right now. And that I have to give him some time to think about it. And it works so much better. And I'm just giving that as one example of how assuming somebody won't do something creates problems. Sometimes it's true, but I think for our kids on spectrum, it's important to assume, to err on the side of assuming it's a can't first before you assume it's a won't. It's difficult to find a balance between being protective about different aspects of our children's lives and letting go. I liken it to walking on a tightrope. We're intent on promoting as much independence as possible, yet fearing the repercussions of letting go. It makes me think of watching a baby take their first steps. You want to swoop in and save them from falling. Yet it's clear that if that baby is going to master independent walking, he must have the opportunity to practice and fall and practice some more. We all fear losing control, especially when it comes to our kids' well-being. Carol Osborne wrote this beautiful book called The Art of Resilience, and she says, of course you should do what you can, but remember there are forces beyond your control. There are things we cannot know. There is mystery. Sometimes it's helpful to have a graphic reminder that this world is quite simply not your show. And one way to really get this message is to go to the nearest ocean and try to stop the waves from rolling in. again, we return to the importance of trying to see the world through their eyes as much as possible. We talk so much about theory of mind. Well, for parents and providers, we too must sharpen our own theory of mind in relation to those we know and care about who are on the autism spectrum. Many of the quotes I've already shared from firsthand accounts from Sharing Our Wisdom book speak to those issues. The quick pace of our culture, the multitude of sensory distractions, the importance of self-soothing. And this is an important slide to just understand, and I think this point was made beautifully earlier by Dr. Tippy, that all of these things are going on a lot of the time for our kids. It's not just for a few minutes a day. This is their world, many of them. It's no surprise to any of you, I think it's so important that we try to develop a collaborative relationship with our kids at as young an age as possible. This is co-creating a vision. We sat down with our son prior to sixth grade and asked him, because he has a very difficult time expressing himself verbally. His speech is very choppy and labored, so he does a better job of trying to write down his thoughts. So we asked him to write down some things that were important to him. And we went to the first IEP meeting, the beginning of the school year, and we handed out his vision statement. And I'll never forget, my husband, who's more quiet, he spoke up and he looked around the room with all the people in the room, and he used to have 10, 12 people at his meetings because he had so many different kinds of specialists. And he said, "I'd like to ask you, where do you see Jordan in 5 years or in 10 years?" And it was complete silence in that room. And of course, like we said, you set out an intended destination on that sailing voyage. We can't control where we end up, but we do want to have an intentional course. Total silence, because people were not used to thinking about the long-term ramifications of decisions that were being made clearly. But it's so important to have our kids' input about what their vision is for their own life to the greatest extent that they're able to communicate that and imprint this phrase in your head. This comes from TASH, T-A-S-H, which is a wonderful disability organization. You can find that online. Say nothing about us without us. I was always told that I, as a parent, was the best expert about my child, but I don't totally agree because my child is truly the best expert, and I try to remind myself of that whenever possible. A few years ago, I read a tender story in Reader's Digest about a young man with cystic fibrosis. In high school, he expressed a desire to try out for track and play the sax. His parents balked. They worried about the effect on his lungs. As you know, you may know, cystic fibrosis is very much connected with difficulty with breathing. The family doctor wisely advised them, let him try. If he can't, he'll find out. And years from now, he'll have the satisfaction of knowing he made that effort. That same young man went on to become a surgeon. When questioned about the wisdom of that decision, he said, to try and to fail, that's okay. But not to try, that's not living. I don't know if you heard Ron Kaufman speak yesterday. I loved his quote, there is no false hope, just false pessimism. As our teens prepare to move into adult life, there are person-centered planning processes that are wonderful tools, and you can find lots of resources on the internet to learn about different approaches to supporting a self-advocate to make life plans based on his or her individual goals. So I would suggest that you Google person-centered planning for teens with disabilities, and you will find a huge array of resources in that area. So let me introduce you to the wonderful person who continues to provide me with incredible teaching. Jordan was 6 here. This was the toughest time we ever faced. in his life. He was in kindergarten with people who did not understand him. He yelled. He kicked his aide. He tore things off the wall. He turned over furniture. He bit himself, bit holes in about 30 shirts. I don't need to tell you what a painful time it was for us, and let's face it, for him, and probably for the professionals who didn't know how to meet his needs. And I want you to notice the vacant look in his eyes and the despair. Let me show you another picture of Jordan. This is a picture of Jordan at the age of 18. He was a senior in high school. And in the spring before his senior year, he decided to run for a class vice president. Of course, I feared the emotional repercussions if he lost, but he kept me on track. He told me, "I'm proud of myself for trying, even though I didn't win. It's much better that I tried than not try. But, Mom, wouldn't it have been cool if I did win?" Jordan will be 25 next month. He still lives at home. He works part-time in a fitness center and takes electives at the community college where he's been a member of an audition-only choir for 6 years. He isn't able to take regular college classes because he can't pass the placement test. He does have some academic challenges that interfere with auditory learning. He currently audits ballroom dance. He takes private voice lessons and is a beginning guitar player. These choices have been made intentionally based on his, number one, his interests, but also, more importantly, picking activities that will create social opportunities so he can hold his own if he wants to go to a ballroom dance event. Or he does have a nice singing voice, so that's a way for him to get recognition. Learning to play the guitar so he can accompany himself. Jordan has been getting help to study the driver's manual to prepare for getting a learner's permit, and we still don't know if he can be a driver, but getting that permit is necessary to determine whether driving will be possible for him. You'll hear a little bit more later from Jordan. We parents need permission to express a range of feelings. Remember that compass at the beginning of my talk? Pride, envy, ambivalence, and even anxiety. And a whole other work topic for a workshop would be the differences between how moms and dads process the emotions and feelings around this journey. But the last thing I need is to feel criticized by somebody else for feeling anxious. Anxiety seems to be necessary in learning to let go. In fact, during those painful, scary moments when I do try to let go, it's most helpful to have people support me to believe that I'm doing the right thing. And of course, when I do that, I'm also making sure that there were adequate supports in place to keep my son safe. As he got older, I had a lot of opportunities to practice, letting him ride 100 miles on the Reuter bus when his high school basketball team was in the state finals, sending him to sleepaway camp with a support person, saying goodbye as he boarded a plane alone to fly across country, calling a job supervisor to reinforce what Jordan had already tried to explain first about his learning style, and of course, there's so many more examples. Parents also need a reminder that their child is a delightful person with great potential who also happens to have autism. There's nothing more satisfying than to have people surrounding your teen or adult who appreciate their gifts and enjoy their company. One of the ways we have experienced that kind of appreciation for Jordan's gifts is through the in-home providers that we hired, who stepped on and off our boat for varying periods of time. I haven't mentioned that my husband has an advanced case of multiple sclerosis, so it has been necessary to have extra help in our house. But so we've had a lot of helpers as well for my husband, much more so actually than for my son. But when he was younger and I was working outside the home, we needed that kind of support. In my book, I reflect back on the number of incredible providers who came into our lives over the years. And I realize how blessed we were to have individuals who made Jordan such a high priority. to broaden this idea of getting support in the community. Helpers show up in unexpected places, and I'm constantly looking for different people who could offer Jordan something. But I'll tell you that I always have the mindset that they're lucky to have the opportunity to meet him. I see my son as somebody who has incredible contributions to give to the community, maybe just, you know, partly just because of his differences. He forces people to open their minds and hearts, but he also has a way of reaching out to people in ways that they feel good after interacting with him, and not many of us can say that. So, for example, I have a rotator cuff issue with my shoulder, and I was getting some physical therapy. Well, there was a very adorable PT assistant, and I approached her about maybe just getting together with my son just so he would have some peers to hang out with. Not for dating, but just, and I told her a lot about him, and she got very excited and said, oh, I'd love to meet him. That would be wonderful. Another example, my son is working at a fitness club, and there's a woman there who he actually went to high school with, and she plays a ukulele. So I suggested that she accompany him on the ukulele singing the Hawaiian version of Over the Rainbow. And not only did it show people at this fitness club, this was at a holiday party, not only did it show people at the fitness club a different side of my son than somebody who has difficulty talking and dusts the equipment, but it also put him in on an equal playing field with a peer, and they were doing something together, and it was a meaningful experience for both of them. I am constantly watching for places where we can bring people in from the community to support our son, but in the process, it's a very mutual experience for him. Parents whose children are becoming adults may also end up getting caught between the needs of two generations. They are getting close to the time when their own parents are aging and need more attention. And unfortunately, when we're sandwiched between elders and kids who need our assistance, too often our own adult needs, including health issues, take a back seat to the needs of others. And this relates back to my number six tool, which is the balance between personhood and parenthood. But one of my pet peeves, and I'm going to come haunt any of you who do this, is to be lectured about how I need to take care of myself because so many people are depending on me. Because really what's happening is people are telling me, well, you're not doing that right either. If they're saying, oh, you need to take better care of yourself, perhaps I need that reminder when I'm overwhelmed. However, I find it much more helpful if someone who cares about me will say, hey, I really want to help you find a way to meet some of your own needs. And they sit down with me and they help me figure out ways to carve out some time for my own self-care and maybe even offer some concrete support to make that possible. You know, maybe perhaps I could drive Jimmy to speech therapy once a week for you so that you could have a little respite time. Or I'd love to bring over a meal so that maybe there's one night that you don't have to prepare meals for your family. There's so many ways that we can reach out and help other people. Well, this has been a theme throughout my talk. Discussing what works best for parents of teens or adults with autism is, again, consulting the true experts. And these are some of the people that I've talked about, and you all heard from Stephen Shore. Stephen is a dear friend of mine. We've had long conversations. A few years ago, I asked Jordan to share some things he needed from me as his parent compared to when he was younger. And this is what he told me in writing, because the speech is much more labored and slow for him. He said, allow me increasingly more opportunities for independence, such as climbing out of bed on time, taking more responsibility for my homework, advocating for myself about my needs at school or out in the community. In the majority of cases, don't make decisions for me without my input. The areas where you might still make decisions include my medical care, my finances, or situations where I don't have the information I need to make a decision. I'd still want you to bring me into the discussion as much as possible so I can understand the reasons for this decision. Listen to me while I process situations and circumstances that come up, especially ones that feel uncomfortable and confusing. Try and let me figure it out first, then give me some feedback if I need it. Push me to take some risks that feel uncomfortable because they are important steps moving me towards adulthood. An example would be encouraging me to speak up when somebody has said something to me that makes me feel hurt. I'm remembering a time in high school where some of the older cross-country guys, Jordan was on the cross-country team in high school, which was a great opportunity for belonging, by the way. He wasn't a great runner, but he was definitely part of that team. But some of the older guys were targeting him at lunchtime and telling him to unbutton his button because the girls liked hairy chests. And he wanted so much to be part of it, but he also had a sense that something wasn't quite right, and he would come home and he would talk to us. And of course I wanted to go in and deck those guys, but I knew this was an important, safe opportunity, and so I would coach him on what he might say to the guys, you know, gave him a lot of different repertoire. Well, he wasn't able to accomplish it on his own with these guys. So he went in and he talked to a very wise vice principal in the school and asked for her help. And she handled it in a beautiful way, called the guys in. They had a great conversation, and it finally stopped. But I felt it was really important to try to let Jordan handle that first before I took over. And as it turned out, I didn't have to get involved, and that was really important. So I asked my buddy Stephen Shore what things he remembers his parents did during his transition to adulthood. He said his parents accepted him as a whole person with the realization that there were significant challenges to overcome in order to lead a fulfilling and productive life. They made sure there were other people who could provide me with support that I needed. I needed role models. I also had older friends I could talk with. I'd see a therapist from time to time. And family support was extremely important. For those people on Spectrum who don't speak, we must never assume they don't have important things to say. Mike Hoover is in his late 30s. He lives in Colorado. He has autism, and he's a strong advocate for people with disabilities. He found his voice through typing when he was 21. 10 years ago, he gave a talk on what makes a good helper. He typed, "People with autism can understand a lot of things and don't like having other people talk about them as if they were not there in the room. The best way is to have the conversation in front of the person directed to them." He goes on to say, "I need those who work with me to have the idea that I'm a capable person and that they do not do things for me, but they do things with me. Have the ability to hear my needs and my high interest in being independent. Be the kind of people who are my best friends and my best advocates, too." Well, I've been talking about how we watch our children grow in positive ways toward adulthood. In the same way, we parents must go through our own transitions as we grow in maturity. As our kids develop, we develop. We don't stop developing just because we're, you know, over 21, obviously. Mary talked about the place of understanding she's come to in relation to her 30-something-year-old daughter. "At some point, I came to the realization that my daughter is going to be who she is. I finally was able to drop the expectation that she be other than she is. My own growth as a human being comes from arriving at the place where I learn to accept the reality of my life as it is." I'm sure most of you will agree that having these wonderful people in our lives helps us grow and stretch in ways we never imagined were possible. I belong to this incredible, quote, club, unquote, of parents, which I did not voluntarily join. We are strong, we're resilient sailors on this life voyage. I am truly blessed to have this son. He's been a source of sadness, but also great joy, and ultimately, he's been my greatest teacher. I want to just show you this slide of some possible books that have been helpful, and of course, there are many, many other books that are out there. You all heard from Stephen Shore. Chantal Cecile Kira has books out now about adolescence. Temple Grandin, of course. And I also want to mention to you an organization of which I'm proud to have been on the board. I thought I knew a lot about autism until I got involved with this organization. It's called the Autism National Committee, and they are truly a civil rights organization for people on the autism spectrum. We actually have, at this point, 6 or 7 non-speaking people on our board, and they're incredible human beings. If you're interested in knowing more about the Autism National Committee, it is www.autcom.org. Check out the website. It's a $10 membership fee for people on the spectrum. And it's a very forward-thinking organization that is very concerned with the civil rights of people on the spectrum. And I am done with my presentation, and I'm looking forward to seeing if we have any questions.
Thank you, Lisa. I just want to remind you, of those of you who are dialing in, if you would like to ask Lisa a question, you can speak with her live right now by dialing *2 on your phone, and I will see that you're waiting to speak with her, and I will put you through. So once again, if you are dialing in, press *2 to speak to Lisa. And Lisa, that was just phenomenal. I've been hanging on your every word, and I have to tell you one thing that I absolutely loved and wanted to break into applause was when you said, when people tell you take better care of yourself. I thought the exact same thing, but never found words for it. What I wanted to say to them is, great, you want to babysit? You know, it was really, I think we do struggle to take care of ourselves, and to have people to help is and to have respite is very important, but it's also, you know, so be very, if you know somebody who has a hard situation, always keep that in mind, to ask people, what can I do for you? If you really think that person needs a break, needs to take care of themselves, that's a really wonderful suggestion. Help them out. That would really be fantastic.
And that brings me to another point, is that we in this culture are not good at asking for help, and we feel like there's something wrong with us. There's actually another article on my website called Asking for Help that talks about the mutuality, and that there may be people in your life who really would like to be able to help you, but they don't know how. And I remember,
exactly,
and that's what my article was about. There was a time, I had great needs in my family, and I took a risk, and I spoke up, and somebody got so excited, and she said, oh, Lisa, I always saw you as so formidable. Thank you so much for giving me something I can do to help you. It's nice to see that you're really human. And it was a gift to her. But people have trouble giving themselves permission to ask for help, and that's what I talk about in that article.
Absolutely. So if somebody says, you know, should take care of yourself, I think it's absolutely fantastic to find a great suggestion. Next time somebody says that to me, I will ask them very nicely, well, could you, you know, do this or that, whatever I need done. And I think that people would be very happy to help. They just don't know what to do. So thank you for bringing that up. Sometimes we parents, we get a little ignored, you know, for our children, and it was a great suggestion that you make. We have some time for some questions from the audience, and you answered some of them. Billy from Burbank would like to know, what do you do when your older teen isn't ready for adult readiness and can't get service? He's tried to get service. He's not eligible for services. He's got a high-functioning Asperger's, and he wants to know how he can help his child face and cope with adult readiness.
Well, I would want to start with the young adult, or I don't know how old this son is. I would want to start with him and what he wants, because again, I made that point earlier that if you don't have, if you're not mutually working on the same goal, it's going to be hard, first of all, to get that child to cooperate with you in developing some strategies. So it's crucial to find out what they feel is missing in their life. Second of all, the point that I made is that we have to believe that if we bring people in to help our child, that it's a gift to them, and that it isn't just a gift for our own, you know, for our child. And I don't know if I'm expressing that, But if you have that attitude when you approach people, you go to them in a very different way. I think the person-centered planning processes might be helpful, where you bring together people who care about your son. And you taught there are actual structured processes to go through in order to identify what are his strengths, what are his dreams, what are the challenges, and then developing an action plan, but having other people in the community get together. I just had another thought of something, but having people in the community get together to focus on this person and who they are and what they can accomplish and how they're going to get there. When I speak, I have this David Letterman type list of the 10 things parents most hate to hear from the public. And the number one, you know, like David Letterman saves the best for last, the number one thing that people most hate to hear is that God doesn't give you more than you can handle. And people always groan when I put that up on the screen because, you know, whether or not it's true, it's not a very nice thing to hear from somebody else. Kind of developed a counter to that, which is God doesn't, if you believe in God anyway, God doesn't give you more than you and the community can handle together. And that's really about what's needed in our culture in general, not just with autism, but we got a lot of problems out there, and communities are needing to work together more. So I think it's important to start thinking about those resources, those people who are lurking around every corner who could be helpful, especially when there aren't some formal organizations that are available. The best resource I have found as a parent, and I can't stress this enough, and I did get a lot of questions about specific parts of the country, are other parents. And if you can possibly either attend a support group of parents of adult kids, because they're out there, or find a listserv online where you can post questions and ask for ideas. Things are springing up all over the country. I know, like, San Diego area has Valerie's List. It's an incredible resource. And I don't want to take any more time listing things that I'm aware of in different parts of the country because I certainly can't address everybody's geographic area.
Right. Very good. Very good. I love this question from Carol. Carol from Los Angeles asks, this is a really great, great question. How can we tell the difference between ASD behavior that you can't change, in parentheses, and typical teen defiance, parentheses, that you can change?
Well, I think I addressed that, and actually it was because of Carol that I, her question.
Oh, okay. I must
have
missed that. Okay.
No, it's okay. That really you err on the side of assuming it's a can't first and make sure that they have the resources. I mean, it's developmentally appropriate for adolescents to be defiant. And yes, as I said earlier, with ASD in adolescents, the defiance might be bigger. But it may also be expressing an insecurity about, for example, not being able to do something, but they don't want to lose face, so they don't come out and say, you know, I'm kind of nervous about trying that. So
right.
They get defiant about doing it. So I would err on the side of assuming first it's a can't and try to come up with some strategies and some supports to help them do that before
so
I would address it as a won't or a defiance.
Right. I recall now the won'ts. Thank you.
No problem.
Cindy from Wisconsin is an OT, and she asks for some advice here. As an OT working in a school setting, generally working with the younger population, I see learned dependency and enabling of this dependency and difficulty moving toward more independence. A continuation of things the way they are may be to prevent outbursts, maybe because it's just the way they've always done things. So the question being how to get buy-in from the caregivers, assistants, staff, family, and the student to progress, even though, yes, it may cause disruption for a short time.
Help me understand that, because that was long. I have
I'm going to paraphrase. Okay, I'll paraphrase. Now, what she's saying is she's an OT, and she sees a lot of learned dependency. And she's saying that she thinks this is because people are trying to avoid an outburst, but she wants, it was a little difficult to understand too, she calls it a buy-in. How can you get people, the caregivers, to agree with her and get on the same page with her for the child to progress, even though it may cause disruption for a short time?
Well, first of all, I would be careful about attaching a label of learn dependency?
Learned dependency, yeah.
Yeah, I would be really careful because that sort of is a cousin of that accusation of enmeshment.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, well, I don't want to say by the same token. I remember the times where I was very protective of my son, and those outbursts are very hard on their nervous system. And I remember being accused by people that were close in our family that I was babying him too much. When in fact, it was I have a son who's incredibly emotionally intelligent now because I gave him permission to feel what he felt. And that doesn't mean that it was okay to throw things and have tantrums and tear things up. I don't mean that. But I got accused of babying him. And in my own intuitive knowledge as a parent, I knew that it was important for him to feel safe because none of us change when we don't feel safe. I want to say that again. And I love that Dr. Tippy made such a point that these kids are no different from anybody else in terms of internally. Nobody can make changes if they don't feel safe. And that's why, you know, counseling, you know, my clients keep coming back to me and make changes in their life because they have a safe place where they have permission to fail or to feel what they feel. So I would say that I understand where she's coming from, that if the kids are going to take risks, their parents are going to have to relax. I would say also that when you're dealing with the parents, take a few minutes, if you can, and I know time is very limited in the school setting, to listen, to hear what's behind the words in the parents, to acknowledge the anxiety they might feel, to actually say to them, what are you worried about will happen if you let your child try this?
Mm.
Tell me, and to actually stay with it a little bit longer, and to let the parents know that you're interested in knowing what's driving their fear. Because when you're running up against that kind of resistance, you're dealing with fear. And, I mean, this is such a great question, and I would love to have more of a conversation with this OT. I would welcome her to email me because it's an important question, and I understand her frustration from her side. But, again, be careful about attaching a label of learned dependence onto that relationship because you haven't walked in that person's shoes. You don't know what it's like to see your child suffer day and night.
Right. Right. That was a really great advice. Ask the parent what they're afraid would happen. That is just so helpful to everybody to actually, you know, try to put words to it. We have, you know, we worry for our children. We worry, mm-hmm. Some of them, we don't even know what we're worrying about. We're worrying about worrying, you know. So to ask what you're afraid of is such a pertinent question, Lisa. Thank you for sharing that.
And to listen to the answer and not try to talk them out of how they're feeling, but just hear them and say, okay, I see why this is hard for you. I get it. You know, and then maybe to make a suggestion that might make them feel a little safer themselves. None of us change when we don't feel safe, our kids or us.
That is so true. It goes without, I mean, it's easy to miss to say yes, ask them and listen to their answer. You know, that
mm-hmm.
that's just fabulous advice. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Now, there are a lot of questions about, I'm trying to paraphrase the questions here. Let me see.
Can I just say, Minta,
please,
that I do phone consults. You know, I can set up appointments with people by phone to do counseling, whatever you want to call it. And I'm able to, I mean, I can't do that for free on an extended basis. But if somebody needs to really focus on an area, I've been doing this for 35 years, and I'm really good at helping people identify what the issues are I have a trained ear, a trained heart, whatever you want to say, and I've walked this journey. So I am available to do that. People could email me or leave a message on my voicemail, and I'll get back to them, and we can certainly talk about how to do that. I don't need clients per se right now, but this is so close to my heart that if I can help somebody in one or two phone conversations to get focused, I'm happy to do that. And my number's on my website.
Fantastic. Thank you. I want to ask a little bit about resources, that not not specific to one place, but I see a lot of people are asking for resources in their city, and of course, you know, we all live different places, so it's very hard to say. But from Oklahoma City, the question is, I see a lot of person-centered planning help and respite care for families with Medicaid or low-income families, but is there places that you can go for help for families of teenagers that don't meet the low-income guidelines but cannot afford to add more cost to the already high cost of having special needs in our home? Would you happen to have any ideas about that?
Well, obviously not specifically for Oklahoma City, but I
right.
think, for example, if I were moving into a new city, I would definitely get on the internet. I would Google support services for, well, maybe even saying Asperger's would imply that maybe they aren't eligible for services necessarily. And I understand
yeah.
that Medicaid is very restrictive in terms of kind of income and assets you're allowed to have. But I would Google something that describes what you're looking for. I would absolutely connect with other parents in the community either through a listserv or a support group, because parents are always going to be your best resource. Forgive me, I am a professional as well, but my best resources have been other parents who have walked this road. And there's so many different listservs available that are either focused on a particular locality, or there's national listservs that people can write into and post a request and just get inundated with responses. So that's something that I might be. I also might be looking into whatever kinds of, I think there are respite coordinators in almost every county in the country that aren't necessarily there just to help people who qualify for Medicaid.
Right.
But again, your best bet
right.
is
the parents.
Yeah,
sorry to cut you off, but you're so right, parents. Son, why do we have to reinvent the wheel every time if you live someplace that right now every place you'll find people with autistic children. You'll find them every place now. It's not like, they've got to be resources in every city now. I'm not sure if you can answer this question about guardianship, but this is a very interesting idea. This is a very interesting question. Jennifer from Orlando asks, is there a guideline which addresses how to determine if guardianship is needed and the types of advocacy choices? She has a 17-year-old that she needs to help decide if guardian advocacy is an appropriate choice for her child. First of all, I'm not really familiar with what is guardian advocacy. Could you say more about that?
Well, when your child hits the age of 18, they're responsible for all their own decisions. And, I mean, I think there's a lot of levels with guardianship. There's a philosophical level, which is that I don't want to have my child not have a legal say in their own future. I will say that a really good resource for guardianship issues is TASH. I mentioned the organization TASH, T-A-S, as in Sam, H.org. They do a lot of things about guardianship. Usually the ARC organizations all over the country will give a little bit more of a mainstream, little more mainstream information about guardianship. TASH talks a little bit more about alternatives to guardianship. We made the decision not to try and get guardianship for our son when he turned 18, and it was greatly from a philosophical perspective that we made that decision. However, we had him go to a lawyer where he signed something that gave us a right to be involved in his medical care, his finances, and his education. But it's not that we would take it over. It's just that And we had his buy-in, to use the OT's word. You know, he bought into the fact that he needed our help with that. But we wanted him still to be able to vote. We wanted him to be able to sign his own documents. And so, you know, whenever I have to do something for medical insurance, I got to bring the form to Jordan. He has to sign it. He has to sign his own tax return. And, of course, I try to explain everything I can to try to empower him further. But every parent has to make that decision for themselves. But those are two resources. I just Googled alternatives to guardianship, but you could easily Google guardianship for transition youth with disabilities. I'm doing it right now as we speak, just to see what comes up. And, oh, my gosh, there's so many hits. And I would just really recommend you do some research about it, because it's an important decision. And it is harder to go back after a child turns 18 and get guardianship if you decide that's the best course of action.
Fantastic. We have just about 3 or 4 more minutes. Sharon from Flushing, New York, would like to address that parent asking about the Medicaid question, and I think this is a very good answer, so I want to share that. She says, the parent asking about Medicaid question who didn't meet the salary cutoff should ask about the waiver program, because it doesn't depend on the parent's salary. And that is true. So that is the waiver, W-A-I-V-E-R program. That is something that you can ask a Medicaid service coordinator about.
There's waiver. Yeah. Not every state has that. We do have that in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So at 18, the parent's income does not count towards
right.
the child's income. But there are services that are available through that waiver program. So I'm glad
yes.
you brought that up.
Yes, so was I. Okay, we have time for one more question, and this just came in. I'm not sure what the person's name. It's a little bit long, so bear with me. I think it's very pertinent. How can we help our teenagers understand that we aren't trying to teach them independence to get rid of them, but to help them? My teenager has an extreme fear of losing me that holds him back from wanting to learn anything. He's unable to read, cannot write, has extremely poor muscle tone, has apraxia, so he is unable to communicate very well and will not try to do these things, and, of course, no interest for motivational rewards. So I'm having trouble even getting him to help himself without a major meltdown, and sometimes I think it is due to the overly extreme fear of losing me. No matter how many times we have showed him and told him we aren't getting anywhere, it can be fun, and he could do more with us if he's able to do these things. So how would you address that?
Well, you know, I am a therapist, so my inclination would be to try to get that child into therapy in a situation where he can feel safe, and maybe the parent has to go with him initially. I would try to find some counseling for him, and I know not everybody can afford it, but, you know, if you have medical insurance, it often covers it, or Medicaid covers it as well. I would definitely try to get that boy some counseling, but let's just say if that wasn't available, you know, I'm thinking about the way Dr. Was it Tippy?
Yes.
Talked about being playful and
yes.
making things fun, and that could somehow expand to that situation. I can't, obviously not knowing more about it, I can't give specific examples. Look for tiny ways for him to be successful.
Yes.
And I can't, again, without knowing him, I can't come up with examples, but watch for moments of success and really make a big deal out of, oh, my gosh, that is so cool. You just ... Did you? Wow. I'm just so excited. You know,
that's
just
to
start
success.
Highlighting successes. And the baby steps are important, but I definitely would try to get some counseling with that. And this, you know, might be a situation where I could be helpful by phone.
Oh, great. Yes, great. Thank you. Yes, she does say it can be fun, so I think focusing on the fun, you are absolutely right on, starting with small things. That's a great
mm-hmm.
idea. Thank you for that suggestion.
Sure.
We are just about out of time, so I am going to ask you if there is anything else that you would like to share with the audience to wrap things up?
Well, first of all, I just want to repeat my website if anybody wants to get in touch, www.disabilityinthefamily.com. And just to remember that our kids really aren't any different from anybody else inside. They manifest it in different ways. And to take the time as much as possible to get them to speak up about what's important to them, whether or not they can speak, they can still communicate. And keep going because it's worth it. It is the hardest thing I've ever done. I'm sure it's the hardest thing that most of you have ever done. But we just keep trying, and we make mistakes, and we just keep going, and we find people who can remind us that we're doing okay.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for the great words and for your time with us today. Thanks a lot, Lisa.
You're welcome. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. So did we. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
We'll see you. We'll be back on in half an hour. Thank you.
Bye-bye.